Welcome to another edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. I am John Schmelk. This guy's Lance Meadow. The phone number for you is 201-939-4513. If you're on Twitter, it's hashtag Giants Chat. The New York Football Giants getting ready to take on the Philadelphia Eagles on Sunday at 1. First of all, it's great to play a game at Sunday at 1. We haven't had one of those yet this year.
Wow.
It don't feel like a regular football game. And, of course, Giants in Philly, Lance, at 0-2. It's hard to really call a Week 3 game a must-win game, but if the Giants do not win on Sunday, they will be in an awfully tough hole to try to recover from.
Yeah, it's extremely a stretch to say that this game is not important, that this game couldn't very well dictate what's going to happen moving forward, and it's simply because of the fact that there's going to be three straight NFC opponents to open the season, John, including two divisional games. If you fall to 0-3 and 0-2 in the division, regardless of whether or not there's the potential of going on a winning streak, it's still putting yourself in an extreme early hole and thinking about tiebreakers down the road. And I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, but I think it's well documented that when you play these divisional games based on what's played out in recent history within the division, you have to take care of business within the NFC East. When you don't do that and you hover around 2-4 in the division and 3-3 in the division, it's very difficult to make up for those losses in those non-divisional games. It's been an issue, and it's been an issue not just in this division, it's been an issue across the NFL landscape. So when you take that into consideration, I think this game is extremely important. I think the fans realize that. I think the players, I think the coaching staff realizes that. But, you know, let's not overlook the fact, John, that this to me is a significant step up in terms of the pass rush that Philadelphia brings to the table compared to what Dallas and Detroit brought to the table. And we saw Dallas and Detroit had success getting to the quarterback. Now you're bringing in a Philadelphia team that has 8 sacks on the season, has Brandon Graham and Fletcher Cox, a defensive tackle and a defensive end that are very effective and have a knack for getting to the quarterback. This is going to be another humongous test for this offensive line.
You mentioned the two stars of the show. Well, let's not forget the side players either. Tim Jernigan was a either early second or late first round pick. I don't remember where he actually went in that draft.
With the Baltimore Ravens.
Yes. He is a sack and a half. Chris Long, first round pick. He has a sack. And then you have Derek Barnett, who is a first round pick this year, the talented pass rusher out of Tennessee. He doesn't have a sack yet this year, but he can play also. And Vinnie Curry has gotten sacks against the Giants before, too. So, Lance, it's not just two guys here. The Eagles throw waves at you, and you're always going to have somebody out there going a million miles per hour because they rotate these guys a little bit. And then throw on the top of that the injury report today, and we'll go through those details as we move along here in the open of our show. Let's start the offensive line portion of it first. Bobby Hart ruled out of this game with his ankle injury or his foot injury, whatever it's classified as. And that likely means, though Ben McAdoo would not tip his cap, smart money, I would suppose, and a safe assumption might be that you're going to have Justin Pugh out at right tackle and you're going to have Brett Jones at left guard. Well, guess what? Two guys now are going to be dealing with Brandon Graham and Fletcher Cox and the rest of these Eagles guys, players playing out of position or backups. So it runs into an issue.
Jernigan, by the way, second-round pick in 2014.
Second-round pick, thank you.
So he was certainly high up, did come over from Baltimore. But your point is well taken. He likes to mix and match personnel, Jim Schwartz. He did that in Detroit. He's now doing it again in Philadelphia. He even did it in Tennessee when he was the defensive coordinator there. So it's not just one player you have to worry about. And I think you hit an interesting point. Brandon Graham lines up against the right tackle. Normally, when you think of elite pass rushers, they put them up against the left tackle. With the Eagles, they line him up with the right tackle, and then they have other guys that they're going to bring to test Eric Flowers. Now, I wouldn't be surprised, though, John, if they mix and match Brandon Graham a little bit. It's not
as
if he's solely just on that side, but for the majority of snaps, he usually lines up with the right tackle.
And by the way, ironically, I believe at least one, maybe both of Fletcher Cox's sacks, when I went back and looked at the tape this week, came against a tackle because they like to run him on stunts a lot, and that'll bring him around the outside of that right tackle or left tackle sometimes, and then he'll beat that tackle for a sack. So you're right. They do a lot of different things. Their front is set up very similarly to what the Lions are. Like you said, they'll run that wide nine. They'll get those tackles in isolation situations. They'll try to bend that edge. So we know the Eagles' secondary is banged up. We have not seen their half of the injury report yet for the game, but three out of their top four secondary players, might have been four out of their top six secondary players, have not practiced this week yet. Corey Graham, Jalen Watkins, right? Darby's obviously out, and McLeod. missed practice this week too. Yeah. They're starting safety. So you have a lot of guys missing in that Eagles secondary. If the Giants can figure out a way to block up the Eagles defensive line, yeah, they'll be able to throw the ball down the field, but let's take baby steps.
Yeah.
You got to do one to do two. We've heard a million times over these past eight games when the Giants have failed to score 20 points. Oh, their secondary is vulnerable. You got matchups. You got to go here. You got to go there. You got guys beating people one-on-one. Take them deep. Well, we know why they haven't been able to do it. Let's see if they can do it against Philly.
Yeah, I'm going to completely shy away from that narrative. We've brought this up so many times. I'm tired of it.
I'm tired of it, too.
So I'm not going to lay out that, oh, this is a great opportunity for the Giants passing game to go berserk because of the injuries to the Philadelphia secondary. We've been talking about it with Dallas. We've been talking about it even with Detroit in past seasons. And it's all about the trenches play. And I think that after the first two games, we don't need to go over and rehash that. The trenches is going to determine this contest. From both perspectives, the Eagles have had trouble protecting Carson Wentz, too.
And let's flip the script now. The Eagles have given up eight sacks.
Yeah. They had six sacks in the last game against a very strong front seven that Kansas City presented. So, you know, just as we're talking about the Giants' offensive line, there's an Eagles' offensive line that also is going to make a change with Chance Warmack is being brought in at the guard spot. They are benching their second-year player who they had in that guard position. So
give the name a shot.
Isaac Semulaile.
That sounds good enough to me.
I believe that's
frankly, I'm not sure how to pronounce either, so yes. I was going to let you do it.
No, I believe that is how he does pronounce his name. And as a result, they are going to go with the veteran, correct, Chance Warmack, who had some starts with the Tennessee Titans. So, you know, we'll see whether or not that makes a change for them. But they've been tested. The difference is, though, John, Carson Wentz has a lot more mobility than Eli Manning. And what shouldn't be overlooked is Wentz ran for over 50 yards against the Kansas City Chiefs on four scrambles. So just like we were talking about, and Spags brought up this point, when you look at Dak and when you look at Matthew Stafford, it's easy to say, well, Stafford just has a strong arm. He stays in the pocket. And what did Stafford do Monday night?
Yeah, that's nonsense. He doesn't do that.
Stafford did a phenomenal job extending plays. It was a third and nine when he ran for a first down.
Which, by the way, they had a spy on him on that play, and he did not make the play. I believe it was Nat Burhey.
And he was still able to
maneuver
throughout the course of the defense. So even when you anticipate that the quarterback's going to be mobile, sometimes things don't necessarily work out according to plan. Well, here now you're going up against Carson Wentz. He will not shy away from also scrambling to pick up the first down. I was watching that Kansas City game closely, and he did it numerous times because he was seeing a lot of pressure and the pocket was collapsing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw in his first touchdown of the season against the Redskins, he broke about two tackles, rode to his left, and threw a beautiful deep pass. I think it was Nelson Aguilar that caught that first touchdown, if I remember properly. And it was a great play. I mean, it was the type of play that, oh, this is why this guy was a second overall pick in the draft. So he's got a strong arm. He can move it. But he will put the ball in the danger sometimes, too. Wentz is a gunslinger.
Yeah.
He's not a guy that's going to, you know, play captain dump off here. He will put the ball into harm's way. So we've talked about the importance all the last couple of years, Lance, of winning the turnover battle. And I said this to Paul yesterday. If the Giants don't win the turnover battle on Sunday afternoon in Philadelphia against a good Eagles team, they're going to be hard-pressed to win that football game. You don't win games on the road against good foes when you lose the turnover battle. It just doesn't happen very often.
And they've had an Eli Manning interception in each of the first two games.
But they've only turned it over a couple times.
It hasn't been overwhelming. But notice
if you turn it over once per game, Lance, that's 16 for the season. The Giants would sign up for that right now.
They would, assuming, though, you get some takeaways of your own.
You
of
don't course.
Want to be minus 16 in turnover differential. I understand the point that you were making. But here's the thing. You could have few turnovers. You could have one turnover a game, but the interception was critical.
It was, yes.
And Detroit capitalized on the turnover because it changed field position quickly after the Giants got a takeaway of their own, and the Lions said, thank you very much, we're going to get into the end zone. So, you know, takeaways, few takeaways may not hurt you, but it's putting additional pressure on your defense.
And it's the timing of the takeaways, too.
Momentum.
Obviously, takeaways in the red zone, momentum,
like
things like that. All that's a factor. A couple other issues with the Giants' defense against this Eagles offense we should touch on. No B.J. Goodson. He's been ruled out for the game with his leg injury. Janoris Jenkins is going to be a game-time decision. He's questionable. He'll try to practice tomorrow. The Giants will see how he goes. Maybe if he doesn't go, maybe they'll change his injury designation. We'll have to wait and see. The Giants do that sometimes based on what happens on Saturday practice. Exactly. And Keenan Robinson is official out of concussion protocol. He will play in the game. JT Thomas out, and Evan Engram is still in concussion protocol. He's right now is questionable. So those are the rest of the injuries to keep in mind. And that linebacker spot, Lance, you got Zach Ertz running around. You want to make sure you have somebody in there that can run around. And, you know, Keenan Robinson last year did a pretty good job, I thought, as a pass defending middle linebacker. It'll be good to have him back in the lineup.
Well, it will, considering, you know, you brought up Zach Ertz, who actually is the Eagles' leading receiver in terms of receiving yards and receptions. But once again, we've talked about this last season. The Giants have had trouble defending tight ends, John. Jason Witten and Eric Ebron have combined for 12 receptions on, it's not so much the yardage, which is 101 yards, it's the fact that they've caught 12 of 14 targets.
And with two touchdowns, by the way.
Extremely correct. An efficient position that clearly the opposition is saying, this is what we can attack. Now, Keenan Robinson is one of their best linebackers in terms of coverage down the field. So the timing is ideal. Calvin Munson will have some opportunities too, as he filled in for B.J. Goodson. I know Ben McAdoo said and Spag said that they were impressed with how the opportunity wasn't big, the game wasn't big, he stepped in, he handled his business. But Robinson clearly is more effective in coverage than I think any other linebacker in this unit. So having him back is going to be key, because if Zach Ertz gets going, and the Eagles have not had a great running game thus far this season. Wentz has taken his opportunities vertically down the field, but Ertz has been doing a lot of heavy lifting.
And don't forget Darren Sproles either, another
special teams as well
person that, well, even in the passing game, that the Giants linebackers are going to have to account for in this game. And one other issue with the Eagles offense, I mentioned Janoris Jenkins, he's going to be a game-time decision. You would love to have Jenkins healthy to try to cover Alshon Jeffrey, only because I think Jenkins excels in those physical matchups. He likes mixing it up and do, you know, hand fighting and all that sort
especially
of stuff.
Especially with taller wide
receivers. Yeah, he does a real good job against them. Now, Jeffrey's obviously a couple inches taller than Dez Bryant even, so that would be a bigger challenge. But I would like to see Alshon Jeffrey getting covered by Janoris Jenkins. It would make me feel better about the matchup if you
I think
that.
It would make the coaching staff feel better, too. I mean, Ross Cockrell got opportunities.
He did a pretty good job.
Correct. Michael Hunter is probably going to get some more opportunities if Jenkins goes down. But, you know, like you said, it changes the dynamics.
It does.
In terms of how now the opposition can attack the Giants. Because, you know, Eli Apple and DRC have to be moved around. And we saw that with DRC. You can't now just keep him solely in the slot, because you may want to put him on even an Alshon Jeffrey because of DRC's height as well.
He was even at safety a little bit in that game in week two.
Which
he was floating in the middle of the field. Messing around with that. So I thought the Giants did a good job of trying to mix their personnel and formations up on defense to try to confuse the lines and what Stafford was doing. But look, you know these games, and this is how we'll end this open before we get to your calls at 201-939-4513. But much like the Giants and Cowboys, the Giants and Eagles are very familiar with each other, okay? These teams are not going to surprise one another with what they do and how they play. They're just not. They know each other too well. And I know I said this going into the Cowboy game, it ended up not being as close as I think as we probably expected it to be. The Cowboys winning that game pretty comfortably. But you would think that this game will not be ridiculously one-sided one way or the other. Let's be honest, the Cowboys-Giant game wasn't ridiculously one-sided either. The Giants scored a touchdown on that long drive to start the third.
It was competitive.
It's almost a one-score game at that point. It's close. So it's going to be, again, who wins the turnover battle? Who gets that big play down the field? You'd like to see the Giants. How about the Giants make a big play on offense? Have we seen the Giants make a big play on offense yet this year? We have not. You need one of those to maybe get things going a little bit. They had an opportunity for two big plays last week. Both were dropped by receivers. Evan Engram on one sideline. Nice play by Darius Slay. So maybe not a drop, but a pass he could have come up with. And then, of course, the Brandon Marshall bad drop, which I thought he really did a good job in the locker room this week, you know, standing up like a man and being, look, I got to go make that play. So, Lance, this Eagles defense, they're going to follow the script. Everyone follows the script. They're going to play two safeties deep. You're going to challenge the Giants to run the football. The Giants have to figure out a way to make a big play down the field. They have to.
Yeah, well, and also what you just alluded to is if they're going to challenge you with the two safeties down the field, you got to find a way to run the football,
that
too. I mean, you know, we're
tough run to run against, though.
It is. It's a very tough, but you have to take advantage of the opportunities that the opposition presents. And if they are going to say, we're not going to let Odell Beckham beat us down the field, we're not going to let Brandon Marshall beat us down the field, then you eventually need to solve the fact that they're not stacking the box with 15 guys, and you have to be productive. And what I mean by that, John, is realistically, you don't have to go out and get 10-yard runs if you get 3 yards per run,
yeah, 3 to 5,
and you set up more manageable third downs, then you're basically giving Eli Manning some additional options on third down where he doesn't have to go for the home run, or he doesn't have to worry about, you know, trying to make sure that Shane Vereen gets enough space to get to the marker. You take a few more chances if you have a little bit more wiggle room on that down.
201-939-4513. We're jam-packed with calls, so let's get to it and start with Bernie up in Kingston, New York. Bernie, you're on Big Blue Kickoff Live with John Schmelk and Lance Metal. Thank you for being our leadoff hitter today. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is the attitude of the team and coaching. One of the things, when I hear all these guys being interviewed after the game and talking about the game, all they talk about is strategy, complementary football, so forth and so on.
Okay.
That should not be the concern of the players. Strategy should be the concern of the coaches. What the players need to be concerned with is beating the man in front of them. That's the problem with this team. These guys talk about all this stuff, but they don't play on the field. They don't beat the man in front of them. And that's got to be their attitude. You know, forget about all the rest of it. You've got to implant that attitude in your players. And we don't have that attitude, and that's our problem.
Well, Bernie, one thing I'll say, playing complementary football isn't a strategy. You know, playing complementary football is like what you're talking about, beating the man in front of you. You play complementary football by stopping a team on third down, and you do that by beating the guy in front of you. So I don't think necessarily complementary football is necessarily a part of strategy by this team. It's a product of playing well. And look, you're right. I think you hit it on the head. I think the guys on the field have to be able to make these plays when they're presented with them, whether it's, like I said, Ingram or Marshall coming up with those catches, a defensive player coming up with a potential interception here or there, Jason Pierre-Paul and Olivier Vernon beating the offensive tackles and getting home to the quarterback. We haven't seen nearly enough sacks from those two guys so far this year. The run defense stepping up and doing a better job against the run. They're giving up 50 more yards per game on the ground than they were last year. So I agree. I think all these things together, you're right. These guys have to do better beating the guy in front of them. That's better execution, which I know people hate that word, but that's really what it comes down
to. Well, it is. I mean, the bottom line is the team is not executing consistently, and I would also classify what you just described, John, as playing above the X's and O's, which you hear a lot, making those game-changing type of plays. But, you know, Bernie, to go back to your point, and this is just my honest opinion, talk is cheap, and I understand it's a cliche, but, you know, when we sit here and we analyze what guys say in the locker room, post-game commentary, it means absolutely nothing. I think it's fun for the media, it's fun for the debate shows and sports talk shows, and it's great. But the bottom line is, it's what John just said. The execution or the lack thereof on the field is going to determine wins and losses. What Brandon Marshall says as to why he dropped a pass, what Eli Manning says over a delay of game penalty, and why the defense can't stop the run is great. So we could psychoanalyze everybody, but at the end of the day, they got to go out there and they got to execute, and that's all that matters. So, I mean, personally, I don't care about all the chatter in the locker room. I think it's over-analysis, which doesn't lead to anything.
Well, I think also it's a question of inspiration, and it's a question of how the coaching staff is or is not.
Well, but Bernie, I don't mean to cut you off, Bernie. Bernie, let me ask you this. If you're a professional athlete, or you're a professional whatever, do you really think if you're a grown individual, you need another grown individual to amp you up to go out and produce? I mean, do I need another individual to get me worked up for this program? That should be my own responsibility. If I'm a running back, I have 16 games to play every single season. You think I need my running backs coach to get me amped up? If that's the case, then these players don't belong in the NFL. Any player doesn't belong. I just don't think you need a babysitter to pat you on the back to get you ready for a game.
I don't know. Don't you think if we go back and look at some of the great coaches, Bill Parcells would be a great example. Don't you think he had a way of inspiring people to play better than to play just a little bit better than what their capabilities said they could do?
Bernie, I would say this. I think Bill Parcells could motivate guys to work harder to improve themselves because he would get on them about mistakes in practice. And, you know, he would annoy a guy so much. He's like, well, screw this guy. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to not make the same mistake again. But I think that's different and separate from giving some type of pregame speech to get guys amped up for a game. You know what I mean?
Well, I do. I mean, I don't think it's a question of making great speeches in the locker room, but I think it's a question of what permeates through the team in terms of attitude. And that, I think, starts with the coaching staff and the head coach in particular. And I think it's just not where it should be with this team and this organization.
All right, thank you, Bernie. Appreciate the call, my friend. I don't sense that, honestly. I feel like when these guys lose, it kills them. The locker rooms are somber.
Yeah.
They give a damn. They're into it. Practices are energetic. They're energetic all summer. I don't get that sense that that's a problem, in my opinion.
And I don't really think that that's been a problem, even if you go back to some other recent rough seasons. Remember, in 13, John, what did the team start off? 0-6, I think. Coughlin was here. And I remember the big part of the narrative was, is Coughlin losing the locker room? Are the players divided? And then, you know, they went on that winning streak just to salvage somewhat of the season. But they felt like they were still willing to run through a brick wall for Coughlin. And I just don't – I know it's a small sample size, but you just don't get the feel that, you know, division or personality or emotion is overwhelming this team right now.
And look, reporters are asking the defenders the questions about, yeah. Oh, are you annoyed at the offense for not scoring? And, you know, nobody's taking the bait.
No, not at all. Max is asked about it constantly. He even responds to the reporters. He's like, how many times are you going to ask me the same question?
It is a united locker room,
yeah,
as of now. Let's go to Lloyd in Pennsylvania. He's up next. Hi, Lloyd.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. And, John, congratulations on your son, right?
Daughter.
Daughter, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you.
Well, he wanted a son, but he had to set up for a daughter.
Shut up. What are you doing to me? You're the worst.
That's what I'm here for.
Go ahead, Lloyd. I have a 14-month-old. Yeah. And all I can tell you is that, like, right around month 10, you're really going to enjoy it.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. I think she's starting to do, like, the whole eye contact thing, and I think I might have gotten her to smile yesterday doing something. So, Lance, you laugh, but it's true. You get, you know, the first 6 months or 6 weeks or whatever, it's kind of like they're just like an eating, pooping, crying machine, and they don't really have a personality. I'm starting to see a little bit of a personality.
You're getting a little thing out of it.
She's snarky. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
The apple doesn't fall
no,
far
it
from
does
the
not.
Tree.
Lloyd, so what do you got for us on the Giants?
All right. Well, first, I wanted to talk about Jerry Reese because a lot of people have laid some criticism at his feet, and I think those people are ridiculous. I mean, it takes, I guess, two losses for people to go back and in hindsight, want to play armchair quarterback and say, oh, we should have done this, we should have done that, we should have done this, we should have done that. But there wasn't anything to do. And I've heard you guys say it over the course of the entire offseason. You can't overpay for a tackle that's half as good as everybody makes him out to be, so he can go over there and do the same thing that Eric Flowers is doing. But I don't want to criticize the offensive line. I actually feel like there's a game plan that should be put in place, and I wanted to give you what my opinion was on it.
Yeah, Lloyd, real quick on what you just said, and I think for the people like you who did listen to the show all offseason long, we went through this process from free agency through the draft. And I'll work backwards because once you got to the draft, you looked at these offensive line prospects, and in my opinion, still, none of these guys were going to walk in day one at left tackle and be able to play that position well in the NFL. I mean, the Jaguars had been forced to put Cam Robinson in that spot because of injury. That wasn't the plan.
Well, retirement.
Right, Brent exactly. Yeah. I haven't taken a look exactly to how well he's been playing, to be honest with you. I haven't had a chance to study that, so I'm sorry, I have not. But go back to free agency, there were really only two players that you thought would fit at left tackle. Andre Whitworth, who went to the Rams, who, by the way, is making, it's either $11 or $13 million a year, one or the other, whatever the number is, it's high. And then the other guy was Riley Reiff, who got almost a $50 million contract over 5 years where he went to play. So the Giants, because of their spending last offseason, and I think all the fans are pretty happy with the fact that Snacks Harrison, Olivier Vernon, and Janoris Jenkins are on this team. I don't think they want to pull back on those. I think they're pretty thrilled about it.
There's
only so many dollars in the budget with Justin Pugh up this year, Richburg up this year, Collins up next year, Beckham up next year. I mean, these are all things that you have to consider when you're planning your budget long term.
Matt Khalil's another guy that I would throw out, but he got a boatload of money.
And Beecham, too.
Correct.
Beecham got a lot of money, but Khalil and Beecham were brutal last year. They weren't good players.
Correct. Well, because you know what? If you have a lot of money, some of these teams, and they don't feel like they're high on the draft picks,
of course,
they're going to go out and they're going to spend.
Well, and the Jaguars were like $80 million under the cap.
Yeah, they
and
had
these
a
other
lot
teams
of more
were like
flexibility.
$60 million under the cap. The Giants weren't in that situation because they spent their money the previous year to make this one of the better defenses in football.
Well, and that's why, to get back to the point, and we'll let you continue, Lloyd, you have to knock it through the park in terms of the draft. So this way you don't have to go on a spending spree.
Where you spend, if you don't spend money in that spot, that's where you have to hit on the
draft. Exactly.
Correct,
exactly. Now, the draft is an inexact science, and sometimes you go in one direction and you hope that this guy's going to pan out, and it doesn't necessarily work out that way. I think a lot of teams can relate to you, but to say that the blueprint for building a team is I am going to go on a spending spree everywhere, it's virtually impossible.
And the Giants,
you just can't do that.
And the Giants did spend draft capital on the offensive line. Pugh was a first round pick.
Yeah.
Richburg was a second round pick. Flowers was a first round pick.
They did that over a period of time.
You can comment on whether or not you think those picks were good picks or they worked out. That's fine. Call, give us your opinion. That's great. But they did try to address the issue. Anyway, Lloyd, we totally stole your call here. Now, please, resume.
Okay. So last season, somewhere around week five or week six, my criticism was the game plan for the running game. And when I realized that we didn't have a fullback and we weren't going to have a fullback, I kind of felt like it was a flawed plan. And, you know, when I told my wife, we were watching the game, I said, they're going to keep losing like this until they actually get a fullback. They need a blocking tight end. We have those two things now.
Yep.
And it doesn't seem like it's been implemented the way it should be.
How so?
We have to establish the run. I just feel like whatever formation needs to be out there, whether it's a strong or an I formation, whatever it is, we need to have a tight end and a fullback out there. And Rhett Ellison is a pass-catching and blocking tight end. He can be used to either chip somebody, whether it's on the left side or the right side. And if you need a dedicated blocker back there that can also catch passes, I don't think Sean Smith is bad at that at all. The other thing is,
Shane Smith,
you see that if we have an overwhelming amount of defensive pressure coming on one side, we need to run some counter plays. We need to run some misdirection plays. I don't see any of that happening, but it's mostly because we don't establish the run ahead of
time.
Well,
Lloyd, remember, in fairness, in that first quarter last week, they ran an end around the Sterling Shepard. That is a misdirection play.
It is.
Which was actually their most successful run play, by the way.
It blew my mind that he did it.
No, but remember, then they ran that play again in the second half, and they lost 6 yards.
Right. But still, even when you take losses on those plays, it's just the fact that when you do it, now they have to account for it, and they know that it's a possibility. When we got the touchdown to Evan Engram, that was on a play-action pass. Not to say that our run game was so flawless that the defense said, no, we absolutely have to stop the run now, but they paid attention to it. They bid on it.
Well,
you went streaking.
Your point is that, you know, moving personnel around, because on the Engram touchdown, remember, he lined up in the backfield as a fullback, and Detroit, I think, was anticipating he was going to be a blocker on perhaps maybe a run play, and then all of a sudden he ran up the field and he was wide open. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily going to disagree with you there, Lloyd. And the other thing that I wanted to add is, because somebody asked me this on Twitter, Shane Smith and Rhett Ellison, I went and I looked at how many plays they've been involved in. And this is where I think you could point to, first of all, it's a small sample size to judge them at this point. We've got to see a little bit more, because Smith has only been on the field in two games for 12 offensive plays.
Which is, by the way, the argument they made for not keeping a fullback last year.
Okay, that's 11%, just to put it in perspective, in terms of the number of plays. Ellison has been on the field for 41 plays, so that's 36%.
Here's the question, and I know you probably don't know the answer to this. Do you know how many times they've been on the field together?
No.
I don't.
That
either.
I do not know.
Okay.
I don't think it's been more than two plays together.
Honestly,
off the top of my head.
Lloyd, I don't know the answer to that. I can effort that. Maybe the folks over at Pro Football Focus can give you that answer. But I don't have that. In fact, I will send that email right now. We'll see if I get
something back. It's a fair question.
It is.
But the reason why I bring that up, and Lloyd, I will let you expand upon that, is because I understand people are saying, well, after two games, the whole point was now there's a fullback on the roster, now there's a blocking tight end. Why is it that they're still struggling to run the football? And I get that, but my argument is going to be, until Shane Smith is in there for more than 12 offensive plays over the course of two games and he's not utilized as much as we were anticipating, it's hard to judge and say that these guys are not effective. That's my whole point.
Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't saying that they weren't effective. My criticism is of the offensive scheme and how to implement the running game now that you have the pieces that you didn't have last year. and you couldn't do it last year. Now you can, but you choose not to.
Well, Roshan, Lloyd, I hear you, and we appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. The one thing I'll point out, too, is that they have been trailing in both games, too. So it's not like they haven't been playing with the lead where they can, you know, start grinding it out, which is, I think, how they like to play, to be quite honest with you. But they have been in those situations based on how the games have gone.
Well, and then the other part of it is also they just haven't had a lot of at-bats in terms of the first two games. Yeah. Plays overall, forget what the situation is, John, in the contest. It's the fact that how many three and outs have they had and how many drives have actually gone 10 plays and eaten up 5 or 6 minutes.
And
very few. Yeah, so, you know, as a result, you know, that's going to impact the type of personnel you put on the field. So I think it's understandable why the snap count is not up for those two particular players in the first two games. But, you know, I think it's fair to look back and say, well, you know, maybe they need to be on the field and there needs to be more opportunities for them to help out the offensive line, aid the protection, and try to get the run game going. I think that's at least fair commentary after two games.
All right, let's go to Mike in New Jersey. He's next. He's up next. How are you, Mike? Oh, sounds Mike. Like Mike just dropped off there. Let's lose Mike, and let's go to Bash in Ohio. He's up next. What's up, Bash?
How are we doing, John? What's going on, lad?
Doing well, Bash.
Doing well, Bash. And Mike, by the way, give us a call back. I'll make sure we get you right back up.
Been trying to get in all week, but I wanted to talk about it here. Everybody talk about the offense and defense. I wanted to get more say into the mindset of the Giants organization as a whole. I know, and we celebrated the 10-year anniversary for the Super Bowl win, and we started that season 0-2 and went down 17-3 in the third quarter with a big defensive stuff with fourth down. So I just want to see the mindset of this team with everybody being one person on this team from that 10 years ago with Eli and Zach. Zach is long snapper. So I just want to see.
Zach Yossi. Yeah.
Eli can, yeah, right. So I want to see what has Eli taught them or anything as far as the mindset of this team as far as going 0-2 and probably looking back at the 10 years and going 9-7 and still winning Super Bowl that year. So is this any type of mindset of the team as far as momentum or anything as far as going 0-2 and that team 10 years ago going 0-2 and coming back about to lose and came back 0-3? Maybe offense, 10 years ago we was the defense where you hit up 90 points the first two games, like close 90 points the two games, and thinking that fourth down stop motivated them as far as push the team. So you think a big play this week probably push the offense toward some type of momentum or going towards the going in the season as far as down the season and everything. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, Bash, you know, I shy away from making comparisons from one team to another, especially when the personnel is completely different. I mean, as you mentioned, Eli and Zach DeAussie are the only two guys from that 07 team. And that Redskins game that you're alluding to in week three, what defined that game, it wasn't necessarily a big play. It was the fact that the defense came through with a goal line stand and they made the stops when they needed to. But, you know, to say that if they get one big play in this game, that that's all of a sudden going to give them an indication that they can continually do this from game to game, it's hard to say that. And I'll go back to the 07 season to draw my point even more. You know, let's not forget, in the second half of that 07 season, after they went on the six-game winning streak and they regrouped and they got back into it mathematically, you know, there were games in the second half of the season where, you know, that offense struggled immensely. I mean, Eli Manning had the game against the Vikings where you had three pick sixes, the Redskins game, I think the second matchup where he had 34 incompletions, which was an NFL record. So, you know, even though they had that big win against the Redskins and it initially gave them momentum, it was not necessarily a sign that everything was going to be smooth sailing the rest of the way. So, you know, my takeaway is they got to find a way to win one game, and then they got to worry about what presents itself the following week. But, you know, don't overlook the fact, and John and I hinted at this in the early stages of the season, and I'm not trying to, you know, create a doomsday situation, but compared to what Dallas and Detroit presented in terms of their front seven is completely different in terms of what the next four opponents are going to present, heading into the bye. And I'm talking about with Philadelphia, then you've got Tampa Bay, okay, with Gerald McCoy.
And Robert Ayers, by the way.
Yep. Then you have the
LA Chargers,
Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram.
Two of that might be the best pass-rushing duo in football, by the way, coming off the edge.
I think that's a fair argument to make. Denver with Von Miller and company.
Who is the best pass rusher in football, except for maybe Khalil Mack. Who, by the way, you get later in the year.
Yes. And then Seattle. No, and I'm not doing this to scare everybody. This is the reality of the schedule.
And then Michael Bennett.
And then Seattle.
And Cliff Avril.
And they got plenty of guys. I mean, they're just like Philly. They rotate players in and out. out.
And
so,
Sheldon Richardson, yes, by the way,
from the Jets.
Damn good player inside.
Yeah. So teams with a lot of depth, a lot of firepower, which is going to be a big test for the offensive line. That's why I'm just not saying, well, what happens against Philly is an indication that that can continue moving forward, because there are so many other challenges coming up beyond that.
Right. Yeah. One more thing I take this offline as far as the kicking situation, I wish Jeff was on. As far as Aldrick Rose, I want to talk about a little. As far as watching him the first two games, kickoff isn't that good with him as far as is it his kickoff as far as his kickoff leg. As far as like the first game I seen that he kicked it off and it went like just inside the end zone, maybe at the like a yard inside the end zone. In this game, he kicked it out of bounds. So I'm going to talk about his kicking leg as far as kickoff. I know he had it strongly as far as kicking a field goal, but as far as the kickoff game, it seemed like it's not that strong. Those two games, I just wanted to get y'all weigh in on that as far as Aldrick Rosa, and I take that offline.
Thank you, Bash. Okay. Appreciate the call. I think the kick out of bounds was obviously a big mistake, and it was a critical error. Ben McAdoo said as much this week in his press conference. I think the short kickoffs are by design. I think he wants the Giants. I think the Giants as a team want the opponent to try to return a kick from the goal line because they think their coverage is good enough where they won't get back to the 25. So I think he's purposely kicking it high and short so the team is forced to return it and they get better field position by the 25 because they think they can do better than that.
And that was something that Tom Quinn has hinted at, the special teams coach, when he's addressed the media. What made that kick out of bounds even worse
was the Engram penalty.
Yeah, and that's not an excuse. It still was a bad kick, and you got to keep it in bounds, no doubt about it. But I think what magnified it even more is the fact that you had the penalty from Engram's touchdown tacked on.
I have not asked Rosas this, so I guess it's a bit of conjecture on my part, but I have a lot of confidence that if Aldrick Rosas wanted to kick the ball out of the back of the end zone, he could, based on the strength of his leg. And I believe it's the Giants' strategy that they can get better field position than the 25-yard line, and that's why they're trying to kick it to the goal line or a yard in or a yard out to try to force those teams to make a return past the 25. And you can also force a turnover on plays like that too, strip the ball.
The risk-reward angle to that. And remember, that was one of the things we talked about, John, when they made the rule change. Mm-hmm. Is this going to now alter the schematics of how you attack a team on kickoffs?
Right.
And what you just laid out is the fact that the Giants are of the philosophy, well, we don't just want to give the opposition the ball at the 25. If we think we have good coverage teams and strong players that can get down the field like a Dwayne Harris, we'll take our chances. The problem is, when you try to get too much into the chess match, it could come back to haunt you.
You know, ball might go out of bounds.
Exactly.
A kick might get returned for a touchdown.
Yep.
But that's showing faith in your coverage teams. And for the most part, the Giants' kickoff coverage has been good this year. They obviously had the one breakdown in their punt return coverage. 201-939-4513. David Cranford, he's up next. Hi, Dave.
How are you guys?
Doing well, Dave. What's up?
Hey, you know, you guys do just, you know, a great job, particularly the two of you. And, you know, this show, I've turned more of my friends onto this show over the last couple months. And, but I just have to say one thing. You're not going to want to comment on it because it's too sensitive. But, you know, maybe a program director that are listening to this, but, you know, someone's got to be able to let Russ Salzburg know, you know how to host the way you guys host. Because, you know, number one, he's sitting there, he's cutting off people like Bam Bam, and he's cutting off people like Tony from some South Carolina guys that you both know and you know well, and he doesn't know who the heck they are, and he's sitting there after we've had two games where every fan to expect that fans are not frustrated after these two games is unrealistic. I mean, I get that fans can be, you know, crazy, but, you know, someone's got to, you know, some program director, you know, has got to listen to this and say, hey, you know what, because this is a freaking great show, and it's been a great show, but it's a great show because you guys know how to host it. So that's my only point there. I know you can't comment on it because it's too sensitive. Let me talk about the Eagles. As we go into this game, guys, tell me from a schematic standpoint, either one of you, both of you, tell me from a schematic standpoint, what type of plays are we going to run over the, you know, to be able to address the fact that, you know, we have this great disadvantage as it relates to, you know, I'm worried about an OC Umanura event. where OC, you know, you remember, you guys know exactly what I'm talking
Winston
about, right?
Winston Justice, yep.
What, Donovan McNabb, mm-hmm. six times?
Yep. I believe it was seven, correct?
Yeah, I think it was seven. Yeah.
Okay, so I stand corrected. And I think the team had 9 or 10 that game.
Yes.
I'm worried about that scenario. And I want to know that, hey, I want to know that the coaches understand that we have this weakness. What are we going to do to fix it?
Well, you know, I think those are great questions. You're right. It was six. It wasn't
yeah, it was six.
Seven. That was my fault. And I think the total game
12
for that was it was 12.
12 times.
For the game.
Oh, wow. Just reading it.
Yeah. That look, and he took it to Winston Justice, and he dominated him.
It was an injustice that occurred.
Yes, that's correct.
I'm sorry. I know. I had to get that.
That
anyway.
Was, well, yeah. That was
I know,
a rough
boy,
one.
I was digging deep into my bag of tricks
Look,
on that one.
There are a bunch of different things you can do. You can obviously, and I think we saw them start to do this in the second half of the game last week against the Lions. You can chip with a tight end and or a running back. But again, like I talked about on last week's show, Dave, once you start leaving guys in the max protect, you're sending, you know, three or four receivers out against seven guys in coverage. It's going to be hard to get open if the defenders have any idea of what they're doing. So I think that's a worry, but I think those are the things you have to do. And I think another thing you can frankly do is run the ball better. And I know it's something the Giants haven't been able to do much the last couple of years. They did well at the end of last season. They actually ran the ball against Philly okay in that second game against them last year. Actually, I think they ran for 100 yards in that game. But if you can run a little bit, that slows the pass rush down. You're in third and manageable more. Guys can't pin their ears, bust, and rush the passer as much. And then things get better. But once you get into those third and longs, I think you're looking at opportunities where you chip and then you go out into your route. So you have the guys out as a safety valve after they chip. It still will disrupt some of the routes and then some of the offense you're trying to run, but I think those are the things that you're looking for that you can do to help some of those issues.
Yeah, and just to piggyback off of what John just said, you know, and you were alluding to this, John, because everybody calls for max protection and utilizing personnel, but then the problem is you're now not giving Eli Manning more options down the field, and the coverage is playing into the hands of the Eagles. So I think it's important if players do chip, they then don't take themselves out of the play.
Correct.
So that Vereen can still be a security blanket, even if he helps in terms of softening the pass.
Yeah,
rush.
Ingram and Red Ellison can hit their defensive
and
end on their
out.
Way into their
Correct.
Route. Now, the problem with that, Dave, is that it is also a timing offense. So the whole way this offense is set up is the guys have their routes timed out where Eli has 1, 2, 3, and every time he looks at the next guy, that guy should be coming out of the top of his route, so the timing is set up. When you start chipping, that's going to kind of mess with the timing a little bit. The guy's not getting into his route quickly. So those are the type of things you have to take into consideration. It's not as simple as a lot of other people make
it. You're purposely disrupting your own route by chipping.
Correct.
So that you need to account for under those circumstances. Just don't do what happened in the college game. I forget which game it was where the entire team tried to chip and it didn't do anything, and then three guys wound up sacking the quarterback. So I'm sure that highlight is on YouTube. Go ahead, Dave. Yeah, we'll let you continue.
I totally agree with you guys. I guess the thing that the fans want to see, and you guys know this well, and I give you guys credit because I think you're both honest in how you assess these things, which is all the fans want to call in and talk about. And that is that we just want to see, you know, we know that we're overmatched physically. So now you've got to look at the scheme, and this is where you hope that the coaches – you know, are looking at things like you're talking about, whether it's chipping, whether it's running. You know, I agree. I think the running game, you both have been big fans. Maybe, you know, Lance, I think this has been one of your themes, which is always running the ball, running the ball, running the ball. And I don't disagree. I think running the ball would be great, and I wouldn't mind. Against the wide nine, I do think that they have chances. Again, if you can make the blocks, which is a big question right now, if you can make those blocks, I do think there's lanes for the running game.
Yeah, I mean, you also need to take into consideration, and the reason why I'm a big believer in the run game, I mean, I think if you look at teams that make it deep into the postseason, they usually have some facet of a running game.
And thanks for the call, Dave. Appreciate
it. Appreciate the
Thank
phone
you,
call,
guys.
Dave. But when you look at the at-bats in the running game, now, a lot of this has to do with your point, John, about you got to look at how games are playing out. You can't continue to run the football if you're down by 2 scores.
You also actually have to get some first downs.
Right. But
that's
I think
the trick,
I mean, you're talking about over the course of 2 games, they ran the ball 11 times,
yep.
Okay, against the Cowboys. One of them you take away because Eli Manning kneeled down. That's why it says 12 in the box score. I'm just saying they ran the ball 11. And I think it was 18 against the Lions. So, you know, we're talking about less than 30 times the Giants have run the ball in the first two games.
I mean, ideally, you like to get close to 30 carries in a game.
Yeah.
They didn't get that for two.
So it goes also to the number of at-bats, and, you know, the rushing yardage per carry is not great, and that has to do with the blocking and the execution. I think that goes without saying. But, you know, sometimes in a game, you have to say, we're going to stick to the run because we believe that over the course of the game, it's going to do something good for us. Yeah. Even though we're not getting 10 yards, even the twos and the threes are going to at least give Eli Manning better favorable third down situations.
Patience.
Yeah.
It's a virtue. Not many people have.
Indeed.
201-939-4513. Let's go to Mike in Pennsylvania. Mike, what's up?
Hey, John Haley, and how's it going?
Doing well, Mike. What do you got for us?
Well, I don't want to talk X's and O's. I'm kind of done with that this week.
Okay.
I just want to comment. I don't get the chance to go to MetLife that often, but I was fortunate enough to go this week. And I just want to comment on the overwhelming positive experience I had from the very moment I got off the train.
How so?
Well, I mean, right from the very start, walking through the parking lot, and I see Brandon Jacobs in a pickup game of football with some kids. So, I mean, I went over to him.
That's cool.
And there's – yeah, I know. Then there's Chris Snee right there and Kevin Boss. And, I mean, it's just – it was like a family affair from the very moment, right from the start of tailgating until, you know, well, even after the game. The halftime show, that was great. I got goosebumps the entire time, reliving that magical season. Oh, right from, I walked through the gate at MetLife, and I'm with my girlfriend, and I see you guys, Paulie Dotts and Jeff Fiegels, and I said, hey, let's go stand in line to meet them. 30 seconds later, I hear over the loudspeaker that I'm in line to meet Otis Anderson. And my girlfriend, she said to me, well, do you want line? And I said, no, are you kidding me? One thing I did notice, I got one of those Super Bowl commemorative cups, and I was looking at it with about 2 minutes left to go. And in 07, we started off 0-2, and
correct.
Look how that season turned out.
That's
granted,
true.
It was an entirely different team.
That's true, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, things do happen. I had a Detroit Lions family sitting next to me, and they were commenting towards the end of the game about how the fan base has been very welcoming. But then they told me, you know, do they always like beat up their team, talking about the fan base? And that one kind of hurt. Like, do they always turn on their team?
That's
so that
New York.
Kind of hurt.
Oh, it is. Indeed.
Hey, look, Mike, that's New York, though. New York demands greatness from
perfection
themselves,
too.
And they demand perfection from their teams. And if the teams don't give it to them, they're going to let them hear about it. It's not just the Giants. In fact, other teams are worse. I mean, trust me. Met fans are about as unforgiving as any group of fans in the world. Jet fans aren't much better, and can you blame them? They don't win a whole lot.
Yeah.
You know, Giant fans and Yankee fans are generally the two more forgiving fan bases, let alone Knicks fans, who still somehow get 18,000 people in that building, though they haven't won anything in 20 years.
Well, the tourists help.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I get it. I just want to remind everyone to, like, let's stay classy, especially anyone going to the game this weekend. Last year, I went to the game in Philly, and, you know, I had people, especially going into and out of the game, you're going to hear the derogatory comments, and I would just smile and say thank you, and I would just comment to them about, like, how I feel that much more pride because I feel hated because I'm wearing an Eli jersey.
All right, thank you, Mike.
You know, at the end
got,
of the day, it's sports entertainment.
Appreciate the call.
You got it, Mike.
Thanks, buddy.
And I think a lot of people need to understand that too. That the whole point is you're aiming to go to a game so that you can be entertained, not necessarily to get into a heated battle. The one thing though I loved about Mike's commentary was he was talking about how he initially walks into the MetLife gate, he sees us up on the stage, and then all of a sudden he finds out that Otis Anderson is to the left of us, and that changes his perspective about how excited he was to maybe meet us. So I'm glad that you got your priorities straight, Mike. That I will commend you for. With that being said, I'm sure we can try to see if we get others to match his type of experience at MetLife Stadium. Which, good to hear, though, by the way, that somebody has come to MetLife Stadium and has walked away. Though, I don't know if you're going to see Brandon Jacobs and Chris Snead in the parking lot. That's not going to happen very often.
All right, we'll now, there's a chance that these lines got mixed up a little bit. So I'm going to ask for a call. We're going to click the line in, and I might not give your name, but if you hear a click, that means I'm talking to you, okay? Uh-oh. So we're going to try line two and hope that's Dave in Rochester. Dave, is that you? Oh, whoever was there just hung up. So they were really upset about being compared to Dave in Rochester.
I was going
to
say, you gave a great indication or a great enticement for them to contribute to the program.
All right, so let's try line one then. Let's go to Nick in the Meadowlands. Oh, that's going to be line three, Nick in the Meadowlands. Nick, you're up next.
All right.
How are you, buddy?
How we doing, Nick?
Hey, how you guys doing? I'm glad you're there, man. Let me tell you. We got some of the greatest fans, you know. They even stick up for each other. Thanks, Dave. And you know what? The other day, thanks, Wynn from Maryland, because I was one of those guys. And, you know, you guys know me. I call up 95% of the time optimistic, even about the O-line, even though I know what I've been seeing the last couple of years. But, you know, I don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear about it. And I'm a coach, and everybody's a coach, and this, that, and the other. Listen, some of us play football, so we know a little bit more than others. But, you know, just to sound like Francesa out there and not give you the benefit of the doubt, if you would have let me kept on talking, I was going to tell him. Eric Flowers did some good things in the game. I saw him pick up an outside rush whenever he turned his man in. He went and picked up the guy on the outside, and he saved the sack. I mean, he did good, but he gave up some big plays, you know? That's all I was trying to get to. But other than that, that's in the past. Let's get to the Eagles.
Okay.
I'm agreeing with you guys. I was looking at, you know, are they going to pass pro more? But I think they should mix it up, and I think they should, you know, run it. I'd like to see more Darkwa. I'd like to see some Ballman a little bit, mix them all in there. But the defense, I just hope they take care of business, you know, because these guys could be dangerous over there. And Carson Wentz, like what you guys saw last week, well, on Monday, there's another thing. Hey, that kid Stafford's getting better and better every year. And he's got a good running back now. That kid is good.
Who, Abdullah?
Abdullah.
Oh, man.
He has to stay healthy, though.
Like, you remember Emmitt Smith when he came in the league, and he just, the patience, and he saw the hole, and he saw daylight, and bang, like a cannon.
I would slow your roll on the Emmitt Smith comparison.
I'm just saying that he hits the
style of running.
He's got the speed burst, you know?
See, you know what?
Abdullah's more of an outside runner than Emmitt Smith was.
Nick started his phone call saying that, you know, he calls into the program all the time, and he's Mr. Optimistic. He calls into the program to reminisce and talk about the 1950s and appeal to Paul DeTino. That's how you should have prefaced
Lance, you know what?
Call.
I got one for you. How about this? You want a little trivia?
Listen, if it involves history, I don't know how excited I am to hear about this.
There's two of you there, so you should be able to handle it, okay? Let's do this. All right. They traded away two first-rounders for Eli Manning, right? What other times have the Giants done that, and who was it?
Wow.
Almost
what
the
was
same
the
trade. But
the last
for a
time
veteran.
The Giants have traded two first-rounders away for a player.
Yes. For the same number, actually. He wears the same number as Eli. I'll give you a hint.
Well, Jeff Eagles wore 10 at one point.
No, it wasn't Jeff Eagles. Did they trade two ones for Tarkenton?
Yes. And what they ended up doing was trading Tarkenton back in the early 70s, and they got three veteran players, a first-rounder, and a second-rounder the next year. And then they traded a first-rounder away for Craig Morton from Dallas.
Okay,
that was the other one.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, Nick. Guys, take care.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Divya in New Jersey. Divya, what's up?
Hello. Long-time listener, first-time caller. How are you guys?
Oh, thank you for being part of the show. Divya, what's up?
So I actually wanted to hear your thoughts about Tom Quinn. He's been here a long time, and I feel like in the span that he's been here, we've fired Perry Fuel, we've fired Kevin Gilbride, Tom Coughlin. I can't remember the last time the special teams was good over a stretch, except for the first year that we got Dwayne Harris. So is it more of the coaching or is it the execution as far as special teams is concerned?
Are you more concerned about not getting big plays in the return game? Is that what you're talking about?
Yep. And even, like, coverage. I feel like our coverage isn't all that great. And kickoff coverage.
Well, the Giants...
And punt coverage, yeah.
The Giants did not give up a kick return for a touchdown last year. So That's very good. They haven't given up a punt return for a touchdown. I believe it was early 2014, Lance. That sounds
the
right.
Ted Ginn touchdown.
And they gave up – the last kickoff was in 2015.
Rashad Ross is 100.
They haven't given up a bunch of big returns. I think the coverage has actually been pretty good. I think Brad Wing's been a great addition as a punter. I think he's been wonderful. You're right. Last year, after Dwayne Harris had a punt and kick return for a touchdown back in 2015, they did not have a punt or kick return for a touchdown last year. That's disappointing. I think you want to get probably at least one of those a year to try to help turn a game for you. But I think that's also, Divya, honestly, an issue around the league now. With the new rules, especially in terms of kickoffs, it's much harder to return these kickoffs for touchdowns because you frankly don't get as many opportunities because there are so many touchbacks or balls going out of the end zone.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And that goes back to what we were talking about with Oldrick Rosas earlier in the show about, you know, the schematics behind, the rationale behind, do you kick it into the end zone or do you try to play the game where you can get some favorable field position for yourself as opposed to the opposition. And, you know, the at-bats, similar to the running game, just haven't been there this season. To your point, Dwayne Harris's numbers did dip in terms of his kickoff return average and his punt return average if you go from 15 to 16. The numbers did take a dip. I think part of that was he was not fully healthy all of last season.
And he played a ton of wide receiver last year,
exactly,
too.
Yeah. So, you know, you take that into consideration. I think that would explain maybe why the numbers have dipped. And also, over the last few seasons, now this is not necessarily Divya different compared to some other teams across the NFL landscape, but your special teams is composed of a lot of 1- and 2-year players. You're infusing your rookies in who make the team. They have to play special teams, or else they're not going to get a jersey. Take, for example, Wayne Gallman has been a healthy scratch. Well, part of the rationale behind that is, you know, whether or not they're confident in keeping him out there for special teams. You know, same thing with a player like Avery Moss. And when you have young players who have not had a lot of special teams experience, Travis Rudolph, who ultimately didn't make the team, but he didn't play special teams at Florida State.
Right.
And one of the reasons why he was trying to get an edge up and staying behind for practice time was to be a little bit more in tune with what they ask him on special teams. So, you know, when you have a lot of young players who you're expecting to make the blocks up the field, you're going to get results that are extremely up and down because they don't have a lot of experience that they're bringing in the fold from college. I think the special teams coach, compared to other coaches on defense and offense, they got a lot more heavy lifting to do. Because in all likelihood, Divya, you've got players on defense and offense that have been exposed to those facets in college. You don't have a lot of that on special teams in college.
And Divya, one other thing real quick. Also, from year to year, the bottom half of the roster turns over so much.
Yeah.
This special teams coach is almost training, besides a few core special teams guys that kind of go from year to year, like the Mark Herzlicks or the Dwayne Harris's, guys like that. They're training a whole new group of players almost every year.
Not a lot of continuity on that.
Correct.
End.
Yep, noted. And I just have one more thing.
Sure.
So I love Eli Manning, and I'll defend him no matter what. So just being a little biased, I didn't like the fact that Matt could have called him out, but I get it. He's calling him out because he made a bad play. But how about the same accountability for other players like Flowers and Marshall, right? So is he just taking an approach where he's altering the method he – I don't know, depending on the players, is he altering his methods or what's going on over there?
Yeah, look, and Divya, thanks for the call. I think you have to understand in your locker room the guys that you treat guys differently. I mean, you don't treat everybody the same. That's the beauty of being a coach. You have to understand each player, understand how you think they'll react to certain things and how they'll handle certain things. And I think what fans have to realize, too, just because Ben McAdoo might say something publicly about one player and not the other, for example, that doesn't mean that when they get in front of the projector in the meeting room that he's not pointing out to other guys what they did wrong in private. He is, trust me. These film sessions are critical. I mean, he's blunt with people. I mean, if you ever talked to Ben McAdoo, he's not, you know, Mr. Pince Words, okay? He's going to tell you what's on his mind, and he's going to be pretty upfront about it. So that's something to just keep in mind. All right, 201-939-4513. We'll go a little bit past one to make sure we get off both of these calls here right here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. Jerry in Florida. Jerry, we haven't heard from you in a while.
Well, good afternoon, John. And
hi, Jerry.
One of the reasons why you haven't heard from me is because basically you guys cover the same thoughts that I have.
Oh,
but I just
that.
Wanted to put together some observations, not talking X's and O's, but basically, just as a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, the Giants' weakest link is its offensive line, and everything follows after that. I won't go into the details about that, but I'm reminded of what John McKay once responded when he was asked his thoughts about the execution of his Tampa Bay Bucks, and he said, I'm all for it.
I remember that quote.
That's a good one. I do remember that.
My thought is that the Giants probably should script and practice their first 10 to 15 offensive plays and really get it down pat to get a head start when they get the ball offensively. And the other observation that I have is
they do, by the way.
That McAdoo probably has too much on his plate as a first-time head coach. And I think he's trying to juggle too many balls at the same time. And it would seem to me that he really ought to delegate the offensive calling to an offensive coordinator with the understanding that he could contribute certain plays and obviously overrule on certain cases. But there are situations in which if you're observing and you're sitting back and looking at the plays and looking at what's happening, you can say this would be a good opportunity to have a running play, and you don't want to use a little scat back. You want to use somebody who can power in from the second or third yard line, and you try it three times or four times in a row if you need to. Because if you can't score four tries from the third yard line, then the season's over anyway. Anyway, those are just some of my observations.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it.
Appreciate the phone call. I mean, the topic of should Ben McAdoo take a step back and maybe have Mike Sullivan do a little bit more of the play calling. McAdoo's addressed that himself and said that everything is at least up for debate and up for conversation this
week. By the way, he also added today that it's not just one guy calling plays anyway. It's you know, during the week, especially when they come up with the script, everyone's contributing. Even on game day, you know, there are voices that contribute to what the next play is going to be as well.
Well, and even Eli Manning this week, John, said during practice, Mike Sullivan calls the plays a lot because McAdoo takes a step back and views the team. But I've brought this up, and I just want to rehash this, because when you're an assistant and you're working under a head coach, John, and the head coach does it this way, it's human nature that if you get that opportunity later on in life, you're probably going to maybe adopt that game plan.
Of course.
We can't forget that Ben McAdoo worked under Mike McCarthy.
Who worked under Andy Reid.
And what do those two guys have in common? They have been head coaches, and they have been reluctant to give up play calling. And McCarthy and Andy Reid also have good track records in terms of delegating both responsibilities, meaning delegating them to themselves, essentially. And that's why I bring that up, because while it's easy as a spectator from the outside to say, well, why would you want to have all those things on your plate? But if the two guys that he learned from are individuals that have balanced both, then I think it's easy to understand, well, this is why he's following that philosophy, because his lens has been through the views of Mike McCarthy, who then learned from Andy Reid, and he says to himself while he's working in Green Bay, I've seen the head coach operate both.
You know
so
what?
Why should I sacrifice that?
I believe I might have made a mistake, and I will say it up front. I do not believe he worked under Reid. He did work under Mike Holmgren, though, who also did call
well,
his own plays
as
the offensive
coordinator. I was taking
it's from
your
the
point.
Tree.
That's what I was taking your
Correct.
Point.
Correct.
No, I knew that he wasn't directly under Reid.
Right.
You were going based on the coaching philosophy.
Correct.
That sort of has been trickled down. But McCarthy—
And it goes back to Holmgren, by the way, who did the same thing.
Correct. But McCarthy, we know for a fact, he has firsthand experience.
Of course.
And we're talking about a number of years. He didn't just get a cup of coffee. Because remember, Mike McCarthy was the one that gave Ben McAdoo his first job when Mike McCarthy was with the Saints. And Ben McAdoo, that story, he drove through a storm because he was so devoted to trying to get an opportunity. And McCarthy saw that in him and then eventually gave him an opportunity. So he's been with McCarthy for a long period of time in his NFL career.
Charlie, we're already over. I'm going to forego your open, and I'm going to give you the floor.
Fine.
Go ahead, my friend.
That's fine. Okay, a couple things. One of the reasons why our special teams is not as good is maybe because Hurts isn't there anymore.
You mean Hurts?
We never gave him enough credit
because,
he was a great special team player. Two, Cam Robinson only has given up one sack this year, and that was from Rakpo. And Eric Flowers has given up four sacks. And you guys were talking yesterday, you and PDOT, about the Eagles were sitting and benching a guard because he had given up four sacks this season. And we have a left tackle who's given up four sacks, and he's our left tackle.
Yeah,
and
but Charlie,
our coach has totally confidence in him.
Yeah, but Charlie, if the Giants had a backup at tackle with the experience of a Chance Warmack, I think we would maybe have a different conversation.
Yeah, I don't think you could overlook that.
Whose fault is having a swing tackle who's an undrafted free agent? Tell me that.
No, that's
so
fair.
So I'll move on from there.
That's fair.
And the other thing I was going to say is that Eric Flowers had a interview. This guy has no clue. You know, he said, I had a good game except for those three sacks. Well, that is a big part of the game.
Yes, it is.
And
that's
he
fair.
Doesn't understand that he is protecting Eli's blind side. He could end Eli's career because of one stupid play on his part. And he is so lackadaisical about it. Instead of saying, yeah, I had a bad game. I gave up three sacks, and I should never have done that. I could have got my quarterback killed. He doesn't have the presence in his own mind to understand the importance of playing left tackle for the New York Giants. Just like Jeff Schwartz said, this guy is a bad football player, period. He's a bad football player. And having this guy still start on our team shows me that this organization does not want to win. They don't respect Eli Manning. And that is a sad commentary on this org.
Well,
so
Charlie,
that's all
the,
I got to say, guys. You know, they got to change it. They got to get rid of Flowers and put him on the bench. And if that means Wheeler plays, or if that means, Pugh moves over to left tackle and they move Fluker to right tackle until Hart gets back, they've got to do that. I mean, if McAdoo's going to call out Eli, he has to call this guy out. So.
All right, Charlie. Thank you,
okay,
buddy.
Guys.
Appreciate the
appreciate
phone call.
It.
Listen. Toying and experimenting with the offensive line, I don't think is a stretch, but if you're sold on moving Pugh to right tackle, John, and Fluker has been viewed as a right side offensive line, remember they made that clear, that they weren't necessarily moving him to left, then the question becomes Ereck Flowers versus Chad Wheeler.
Right now, because of the heart injury, that is
okay,
the question.
So if that's
correct.
The option then, okay, and Flowers has struggled, that's been well documented, nobody's denying that. But Wheeler has very limited experience. Do you still feel that Wheeler is a better option than Flowers based on what the coaching staff has seen in practice? And are you putting Eli Manning in further danger by switching out Flowers, even though he struggled with a guy that has even less experience than Ereck Flowers?
Correct. And I was dumb enough to get myself embroiled in a back and forth on Twitter late last night during the fourth quarter of that Rams-Niners game. And the point that the person I was debating with, first of all, he wanted to put Flowers at right tackle and say, oh, he'll be fine at right tackle. He'll be better there, which there's no evidence to actually back
no,
that
not.
Up. There's
and
zero.
You don't think that the defense is going to scheme to then move their guys around?
The other team's best pass rushers in the next 5 weeks all line up over the right tackle.
So,
we went through them.
So move Flowers to right tackle
anyway.
And have him go up against Brandon Graham and Von Miller. But anyway.
Yes, and Michael Bennett
and
all these other
well,
guys.
Yeah.
That's not the point I was trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is that the only answer I ever get is that, oh, it can't be any worse. No.
Well, how do you know that?
It can be worse. Have you watched the Seattle Seahawks this year? Russell Wilson is like Harrison Ford in The Fugitive. He's running for his damn life every second he's back there. He doesn't have a chance. He doesn't have a chance. It can be worse. And the coaches are watching these guys in practice every day. If they believed that Chad Wheeler would be a better player at left tackle than Ereck Flowers, in my heart of hearts, I believe that would be a move that they would make. They've seen Chad Wheeler in practice, and by the way, in a lot of these preseason games. He played left tackle a ton in the preseason. He was out there for, two quarters at least in every single game. If they believe that he was a better player than Ereck Flowers at left tackle, he would be in the game. They obviously do not believe that. We don't have access to practice. I can tell you, over the course of training camp, when we watch practice, as you might imagine, from any undrafted free agent that you put out there at left tackle as a rookie, he struggled. He struggled. There were issues out there. When he got lined up against JPP in one-on-ones, which happened a few times, it wasn't pretty. It did not go well for him. But again, I'm not trying to kill Chad Wheeler. That's not my point. He's an undrafted rookie free agent at left tackle. Those guys do not come in and start at left tackle in their first year in the league. It doesn't happen. Period. Stop. Conversation over.
Yeah.
Now, if the coaches over the course of the year see improvement from Wheeler and they believe he can play better than what they have, as Ben McAdoo said, and I will quote Ben McAdoo at the press conference because he basically encapsulated what I just rambled about for 3 minutes in one quote, and it was perfect. I'm going to bring it up.
Do you have the transcript?
I want to make sure I read it properly. No, they have not sent
that's
that
what I was going to say, because I don't remember getting the transcript.
I was hoping they had. But I will paraphrase Ben McAdoo instead of quoting him. The best five – someone asked him about whether or not there's a better tackle on the roster than Eric Flowers. That was the question he was asked. Very
fair
similar
question
to what Charlie just asked. Yeah. And he goes, it's not about who the better tackle is. It's about the best five offensive linemen. And the best five offensive linemen on this roster will play on Sunday. The best five. So I'm going to take the coach at his word. If there was a better offensive lineman out there than Eric Flowers on this roster, they'd be playing. That's what Ben McAdoo said. I have no reason not to believe him. And they believe that the guys they're putting out there are the best guys in the roster with the best chance of getting the job done. There's nothing else I could say.
See, the wild card here is what happens in practice. You know, and since training camp has ended, you know, we're not seeing what's going on a daily basis. They're evaluating these players. So, you know, it's simple.
Every day.
It's simple to watch a game and say, well, this guy's struggling, so the simple solution is take him out. But if they're not content with what the backup is doing in practice, then how are they going to get confident enough to put him in a game?
And the soundbite I use in our game open this week for the radio, you'll hear on Sunday on WCBS News Radio 880 at around 12:45 when we roll our game open. Ben McAdoo says, jobs are not given to people. Jobs are earned by people. They are won by people. They're not just going to give somebody a job because somebody else is not playing well. That other person has to be able to win that job and play well enough to earn that job. That's the head coach's words. That hasn't happened in this situation yet. Will it? Down the road? Who knows? I don't know. I don't know how close it is. It might not even be close, or it might be really close. I don't know. I have no idea, and you folks don't know either. The only people that know are the offensive line coach, Ben McAdoo, and probably the front office, and Mike Sullivan. That's probably the only people that know. We'll see. I don't know. That's it.
Time will tell.
And by the way, Pro Football Focus got back to me. How many plays together do you think Ellison and Shane Smith have been on the field together for?
Well, let's see. One played, I told you, 12 snaps. The other one played 41.
Correct.
So if Shane Smith, I mean, we're talking about such a small sample size to begin with him on the field. I'm going to say they were maybe on the field two or three times.
Seven, believe it or not.
Really?
That's, more than
that's
I thought
higher
it was going to be.
Expected.
Yes.
Seven, so that means of the 12 snaps that Smith has played, seven has involved Red Ellison being on the field. Because remember, he's on the field for a very short period of time. So they've been actually utilizing the two of them together whenever they've been on the field, which is interesting based on the numbers.
Absolutely.
But then again, you know, it's still such a small sample size of seven. It's surprising for us to hear, knowing how many snaps that Smith has played, but you still need, I think, more at-bats of the two of them on the field together to truly see whether or not they can make an impact and help out the offensive line.
Well, folks, if you like what you heard today, you can tune in to the Giants Radio Network pregame show. It comes away at 11:30. On WCBS News Radio 880, or if you're on our radio network across the country, it starts at noon. Make sure you tune in. Myself, Lance Meadow, Paul Dottino, and Jeff Fields. I was going to call him Paul Fields for a second. We'll be with you breaking
nice
down
combo.
And getting you ready for the Giants and the Eagles at 1 o'clock from Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hopefully Paul Dottino doesn't get abducted while he's doing his walks on Saturday night. I told him to make sure he's to steer clear of West Philly while he was out there.
Yes, yes. I think that would be wise. So, but, you know, Paul's, I think, a little bit tougher than we give him credit
for. He's also fast.
Yes, he is. He's elusive. Yes. Elusive would be a very good word.
Anyway, we'll see you on Sunday. Yeah. Have a great weekend, and hopefully we'll be talking to you on Monday after a Giants win. It'll be a tough game against the Eagles, division rival. And the tough things about games like these, Lance, even if the Giants play well, there's still a chance that they lose the game. So hopefully the Giants play a lot better and enjoy the game. We'll see you on Monday. Have a good one, everybody.
Have a good one.